4. As every culture has its own mode of thinking in money, so also it has its proper money symbol, through which it brings to visible expression its principle of valuation in the economic field. This something, a sense actualizing of the thought, is in importance fully the equal of the spoken, written or drawn figures and other symbols of the mathematic. Here lies a deep and fruitful domain of inquiry, so far almost unexplored. Not even the basic notions have been correctly enunciated, and it is therefore quite impossible today to translate intelligibly the money idea that underlay the barter and the bill business of Egypt, the banking of Babylonia, the bookkeeping of China, and the capitalism of the Jews, Parsis, Greeks and Arabs from Harun al-Rashid's day. All that is possible is to set forth the essential opposition of Apollinean and Faustian money. The one, money as magnitude, and the other, money as function. Economically, as in other ways, classical man saw his world around as a sum of bodies that changed their place, travelled, drove or hit or annihilated one another, as in Democritus's description of nature. Man was a body among bodies, and the polis, as some thereof, a body of higher order. All the needs of life consisted in corporeal quantities, and money too therefore represented such a body, in the same way as an Apollo statue represented a god. About 650, simultaneously with the stone body of the Doric temple and the free statue true modelled in the round, appeared the coin, a metal weight of beautiful impressed form. Value as a magnitude had long existed, in fact as long as this culture itself. In Homer, a talent is a little aggregate of gold, in bullion and decorative objects of a definite total weight. The shield of Achilles represents 2 talents of gold, and even as late as Roman times, it was usual to specify silver and gold vessels by weight. The discovery of the classically formed money body, however, is so extraordinary that we have not even yet grasped it in its deep and purely classical significance. We regard it as one of the achievements of humanity, and so we strike these coinages everywhere, just as we put statues in our streets and squares. So much and no more it is within our power to do. We can imitate the shape, but we cannot impart the same economic significance thereto. The coin as money is a purely classical phenomenon, only possible in an environment conceived wholly on Euclidean ideas, but there creatively dominant over all economic life. Notions like income, resources, debt, capital, meant in the classical cities something quite different from what they mean to us. They meant not economic energy radiating from a point, but a sum of valuable objects in hand. Wealth was always a mobile cash supply, which was altered by addition and subtraction of valuable objects, and had nothing at all to do with possessions in land, for in classical thinking the two were completely separate. Credit consisted in the lending of cash in the expectation that the loan would be repaid in cash. Catiline was poor because, in spite of his wide estates, he could find nobody to lend him the cash that he needed for his political aims. And the immense debts of Roman politicians had for their ultimate security not their equivalent in land, but the definite prospect of a province to be plundered of its movable assets. Footnote. How difficult it was for classical man to figure to himself the transformation of a physically indefinable asset like land into bodily money is shown by the stone posts, oroi, on land in Greece, which were meant to represent the mortgages on it, and by the Roman method of sale, per as et libram, in which a clod of earth was handed over for a coin in the presence of witnesses. Consequently, trade in goods, properly so called, never existed, nor anything like, for example, a current price for arable land. A regular relation between land value and money value was as unthinkable to the classical mind as such a relation between artistic value and money value. Intellectual, i.e. incorporeal, products like dramas and frescoes possessed economically no value at all. End of footnote. In the light of this, and only in the light of this, we begin to understand certain phenomena such as the mass execution of the wealthy under the second Tyrannus, and the Roman proscriptions, with the object of seizing a large part of the cash current in the community, and the melting down of the Delphian temple treasure by the Phocians in the Sacred War, of the art treasures of Corinth by Mummius, and of the last votive offerings in Rome by Caesar, in Greece by Sulla, in Asia Minor by Brutus and Cassius, without regard to artistic value, when the noble stuffs and metals and ivory were needed. Footnote. Not very much can have been left of classical art treasures even by Augustus's time. The refined Athenians themselves thought far too unhistorically to be moved to spare a chryselephantine statue merely because it was the work of Phidias. It is worth remembering that the gold parts of the famous Athene figure of the Parthenon Keller were made removable and tested for weight from time to time. Economic use of them, therefore, was provided for from the outset. End of footnote. The captured statues and the vessels borne in the triumphs were, in the eyes of the spectators, sheer cash, and Mommsen could attempt to determine the site of Varus's disaster by the places in which coin hoards were unearthed. For the Roman veteran carried his whole property in precious metal on his person. Classical wealth does not consist in having possessions, but piling money. A classical money market was not a centre of credit, like the bourses of our world and of ancient Thebes, but a city in which an important part of the world's cash was actually collected. It may be taken that in Caesar's time much more than half of the classical world's gold was in Rome. But when, from about Hannibal's time, this world advanced into the state of unlimited plutocracy, the naturally limited mass of precious metals and materially valuable works of art in its sphere of control became hopelessly inadequate to cover needs, and a veritable craving set in for new bodies capable of being used as money. Then it was that men's eyes fell upon the slave, who was another sort of body, but a thing and not a person, and capable, therefore, of being thought of as money. From that point, classical slavery became unique of its kind in all economic history. The properties of the coin were extended to apply to living objects, and the stock of men in the regions opened up to the plunderings of proconsuls and tax farmers became as interesting as the stock of metal. A curious sort of double valuation developed. The slave had a market price, although ground and soil had not. He served for the accumulation of great uninvested fortunes, and hence the enormous slave masses of the Roman period, which are entirely inexplicable by any other sort of necessity. So long as man needed only as many slaves as he could gainfully employ, their number was small and easily covered by the prisoners of war and judgment debtors. Footnote. The belief that slaves ever constituted, even in Athens or Aegina, as much as a third of the population, is a complete delusion. On the contrary, the revolutions of the period after 400 presuppose an enormous surplus of free paupers. End of footnote. It was in the 6th century that Chios made a beginning with the importation of bought slaves, Agaironites. The difference between these and the far more numerous paid labourers was originally of a political and legal, not an economic kind. As the classical economy was static and not dynamic, and was ignorant of the systematic opening up of energy sources, the slaves of the Roman age did not exist to be exploited in work, but were employed, more or less, so that the greatest possible number of them could be maintained. Specially presentable slaves, possessing particular qualifications of one sort or another, were preferred, because for equal cost of maintenance, they represented a better asset. They were loaned, as cash was loaned, and they were allowed to have businesses on their account so that they could become rich. Free labour was undersold. All this so as to cover, at any rate, the upkeep of this capital. The bulk of them cannot have been employed at all. Footnote. Herein lies the difference between this slavery and the sugar slavery of our own Baroque. The latter represents a threshold phase of our machine industry, an organisation of living energy, which began with man fuel, but presently passed over to coal fuel. And slavery came to be considered immoral only when coal had established itself. Looked at from this angle, the victory of the North in the American Civil War, 1865, meant the economic victory of the concentrated energy of coal over the simple energy of the muscles. End of footnote. Slaves answered their purpose by simply existing as a stock of money in hand, which was not bound up to a natural limit, like the stock of metal available in those days. And through that very fact, the need of slaves grew and grew indefinitely and led not only to wars that were undertaken simply for slave getting, but to slave hunting by private entrepreneurs all along the Mediterranean coasts, which Rome winked at, and to a new way of making the proconsuls' fortunes, which consisted in bleeding the population of a region and then selling it into slavery for debt. The market of Delos must have dealt with 10,000 slaves a day. When Caesar went to Britain, the disappointment caused in Rome by the money poverty of the Britons was compensated by the prospect of rich booty in slaves. When, for example, Corinth was destroyed, the melting down of the statues for coinage and the auctioning of the inhabitants at the slave mart were, for classical minds, one and the same operation: the transformation of corporeal objects into money. In extremist contrast to this stands the symbol of Faustian money, money as function, the value of which lies in its effect and not its mere existence. The specific style of this economic thinking appears already in the way in which the Normans of AD 1000 organized their spoils of men and land into an economic force. Footnote. The resemblance with the Egyptian administration under the Old Kingdom and the Chinese in the earliest Chu period is unmistakable. End of footnote. Comparing the pure book valuation of these ducal officials, commemorated in our words check, account and checking, with the contemporary gold talent of the Iliad, one meets at the very outset of the culture the rudiments of its modern credit system, which is the outcome of confidence in the force and durability of its economic mode, and with which the idea of money in our sense is almost identical. These financial methods, transplanted to the Roman Kingdom of Sicily by Roger II, were developed by the Hohenstaufen Emperor Frederick II, about 1230, into a powerful system, far surpassing the original in dynamism, and making him the first capitalist power of the world. Footnote. Leonardo Pisano, whose Liber Abaci, 1202, was authoritative in accountancy till well beyond the Renaissance, and who introduced, besides the Arabian system of numerals, negative numbers to indicate debit, was promoted by the great Hohenstaufen. End of footnote. And while this fraternization of mathematical thinking power and royal will to power made its way from Normandy into France and was applied on the grand scale to the exploitation of conquered England, to this day English soil is nominally royal domain, its Sicilian side was imitated by the Italian city republics, and, as their ruling patricians soon took the methods of the civic economy into use for their private bookkeeping, spread over the commercial thought and practice of the whole Western world. Little later, the Sicilian methods were adopted by the Order of the Teutonic Knights and by the Dynasty of Aragon. And it is probably to these origins that we should assign the model accountancy of Spain in the days of Philip II and of Prussia in those of Frederick William I. The decisive event, however, was the invention, contemporary with that of the classical coin about 650, of double-entry bookkeeping by Fra Luca Pacioli in 1494. Goethe calls this, in Wilhelm Meister, one of the finest discoveries of the human intellect, and indeed its author may without hesitation be ranked with his contemporaries Columbus and Copernicus. To the Normans we owe our modes of reckoning, and to the Lombards our bookkeeping. These, be it observed, were the same two Germanic stocks which created the two most suggestive juristic works of the early Gothic, and whose longing into distant seas gave the impulses for the two discoveries of America. Double-entry bookkeeping is born of the same spirit as the system of Galileo and Newton. With the same means as these, it orders the phenomenon into an elegant system, and it may be called the first cosmos built up on the basis of a mechanistic thought. Double-entry bookkeeping discloses to us the cosmos of the economic world by the same method as later the cosmos of the stellar universe was unveiled by the great investigation of natural philosophy. Double-entry bookkeeping rests on the basic principle, logically carried out, of comprehending all phenomena purely as quantities. Zombart, Der moderne Kapitalismus. Double-entry bookkeeping is a pure analysis of the space of values, referred to a coordinate system of which the origin is the firm. The coinage of the classical world had only permitted of arithmetical compilations with value magnitudes. Here, as ever, Pythagoras and Descartes stand opposed. It is legitimate for us to talk of the integration of an undertaking, and the graphic curve is the same optical auxiliary to economics as it is to science. The classical economy world was ordered, like the cosmos of Democritus, according to stuff and form. A stuff, in the form of a coin, carries the economic movement and presses against the demand unit of equal value quantity at the place of use. Our economy world is ordered by force and mass. A field of money tensions lies in space and assigns to every object, irrespective of its specific kind, a positive or negative effect value, which is represented by a book entry. Footnote. There is a close relation between our picture of the nature of electricity and the process of the clearing house, in which the positive and negative money positions of several firms, centres of tension, are equated amongst themselves by a purely mental act, and the true position made presentable by a booking. End of footnote. Quod non est in libris, non est in mundo. But the symbol of the functional money thus imagined, that which alone may be compared with the classical coin, is not the actual book entry, nor yet the share voucher, check, or note, but the act by which the function is fulfilled in writing. And the role of the value paper is merely to be the generalized historical evidence of this act. Yet side by side with this, the West, in its unquestioning admiration of the classical, has gone on striking coins, not merely as tokens of sovereignty, but in the belief that this evidenced money was money corresponding in reality to the economics in thought. In just the same way, even within the Gothic Age, we took over Roman law with its equating of things to bodily magnitudes, and the Euclidean mathematic, which was built upon the concept of number as magnitude. And so it befell that the evolution of these three intellectual form worlds of ours proceeded, not like the Faustian music, in a pure and flower-like unfolding, but in the shape of a progressive emancipation from the notion of magnitude. The mathematic had already achieved this by the close of the Baroque Age. The jurisprudence, on the other hand, has not yet even recognized its coming task. But this century is going to set it, and to demand that which for Roman jurists was the self-evident basis of law, namely the inward congruence of economic and legal thought, and an equal practical familiarity with both. The conception of money that was symbolized in the coin agreed precisely with the classical thing law. But with us there is nothing remotely like such an agreement. Our whole life is disposed dynamically, not statically and stoically. Therefore our essentials are forces and performances, relations and capacities, organizing talents and intuitive intellects, credit, ideas, methods, energy sources, and not mere existence of corporeal things. The Romanist thing thought of our jurists, and the theory of money that consciously or unconsciously starts from the coin, are equally alien to our life. The vast metallic hoard to which, in imitation of the classical, we were continually adding till the World War came, has indeed made a role for itself off the main road, but with the inner form, tasks and aims of modern economy, it has nothing to do. And if as the result of the war it were to disappear from currency altogether, nothing would be altered thereby. Footnote. In our culture, the credit of a country rests upon its economic capacity and the political organization thereof, which imparts to the operations and bookings of finance the character of real money creations, and not on any quantity of gold that may be put into this or that. It is the classicist superstition that raises the gold reserve to the status of an actual measure of credit, actual in that the level of credit is thereby made dependent not upon will, but upon can. But the current coins are wares which, relatively to national credit, possess a price. The poorer the credit, the higher the price of gold, so that thenceforth it can only be upheld against that of other wares. Thus, gold is measured, like other wares, against the unit of book reckoning, and not vice versa, as the term gold standard suggests. It serves also as means of payment in minor transactions, as for that matter a postage stamp does. In old Egypt, whose money thought is astoundingly like the Western, there was nothing resembling the coin even under the new empire. The written transfer was entirely sufficient, and the classical coins that filtered in from 650 to the founding of Alexandria and the Hellenistic regime were usually cut to pieces and reckoned by weight as a ware. End of footnote. Unhappily, the modern national economics were founded in the age of classicism. Just as statues and vases and stiff dramas alone counted as true art, so also finely stamped coins alone counted as true money. What Josiah Wedgwood, 1758, aimed at with his delicately toned reliefs and cups, that also at bottom Adam Smith aimed at in his theory of value, namely the pure present of tangible magnitudes. For it is entirely consonant with the illusion that money and pieces of money are the same, to measure the value of a thing against the magnitude of a quantity of work. Here work is no longer an effecting in a world of effects, a working which can differ infinitely from case to case as to inward worth and intensity and range, which propagates itself in wider and wider circles, and like an electric field may be measured but not marked off, but the result of the effecting, considered entirely materially, that which is worked up, a tangible thing showing nothing noteworthy about it except just its extent. In reality, the economy of the European-American civilization is built up on work of a kind in which distinctions go entirely according to the inner quality. More so than ever in China or Egypt, let alone the classical world. It is not for nothing that we live in a world of economic dynamism, where the works of the individual are not additive in the Euclidean way, but functionally related to one another. The purely executive work, which alone Marx takes into account, is in reality nothing but the function of an inventive ordering and organizing work. It is from this that the other derives its meaning, relative value, and even possibility of being done at all. The whole world economy since the discovery of the steam engine has been the creation of a quite small number of superior heads, without whose high-grade work everything else would never have come into being. But this achievement is of creative thinking, not a quantum, which is why it does not exist for our present jurisprudence. And its value is not to be weighed against a certain number of coins. Rather, it is itself money, Faustian money, namely, which is not minted, but thought of as an efficient centre coming up out of a life. And it is the inward quality of that life which elevates the thought to the significance of a fact. Thinking in money generates money. That is the secret of the world economy. When an organizing magnate writes down a million on paper, that million exists, for the personality as an economic center vouches for a corresponding heightening of the economic energy of his field. This, and nothing else, is the meaning of the word credit for us. But all the gold pieces in the world would not suffice to invest the actions of the manual worker with a meaning, and therefore a value, if the famous expropriation of the expropriators were to eliminate the superior capacities from their creations. Were this to happen, these would become soulless, willless, empty shells. Thus, in fact, Marx is just as much a classical, just as truly a product of the Romanist law thought as Adam Smith. He sees only the completed magnitude, not the function. And he would like to separate the means of production from those whose minds, by the discovery of methods, the organization of efficient industries, and the acquisition of outlet markets, alone turn a mass of bricks and steel into a factory, which, if their forces find no field of play, do not occur. Footnote. All this equally holds good for the case of workers taking over the leadership of the works. Either they are incapable of management and the business collapses, or they are capable of something, and then they themselves become inwardly entrepreneurs and think thenceforward only of maintaining their power. No theory can eliminate this fact from the world, for so life is. End of footnote. If anyone seeks to enunciate a theory of modern work, let him begin by thinking of this basic trait of all life. There are subjects and objects in every kind of life as lived. And the more important, the more rich in form the life is, the clearer the distinction between them. As every stream of being consists of a minority of leaders and a huge majority of lead, so every sort of economy consists in leader work and executive work. The frog's perspective of Marx and the social ethical ideologues shows only the aggregate of last small things. But these only exist at all in virtue of the first things. And the spirit of this world of work can be grasped only through a grasp of its highest possibilities. The inventor of the steam engine, and not its stoker, is the determinant. The thought is what matters. And similarly, thinking in money has subjects and objects. Those who, by force of their personality, generate and guide money, and those who are maintained by money. Money of the Faustian brand is the force distilled from economy dynamics of the Faustian brand. And it appertains to the destiny of the individual, on the economic side of his life destiny, that he is inwardly constituted to represent a part of this force, or that he is, on the contrary, nothing but mass to it. 5. The word capital signifies the centre of this thought, not the aggregate of values, but that which keeps them in movement as such. Capitalism comes into existence only with the world city existence of a civilization, and it is confined to the very small ring of those who represent this existence by their persons and intelligence. Its opposite is the provincial economy. It was the unconditional supremacy achieved by the coin in classical life, including the political side of that life, that generated the static capital, the aformi, or starting point, that by its existence drew to itself, in a sort of magnetic attraction, things and again things en masse. It was the supremacy of book values, whose abstract system was quickly detached from personality by double-entry bookkeeping, and worked forward by virtue of its own inward dynamism, that produced the modern capital that spans the whole earth with its field of force. Footnote. Thus it is only since 1770 that the banks have become centres of an economic power which made its first intervention with politics at the Congress of Vienna. Till then, the banker had in the main concerned himself with bill business. The Chinese and even the Egyptian banks had a different significance, and the classical banks, even in the Rome of Caesar's day, may best be described as cash tills. They collected the yield of taxes in cash and lent cash against replacement. Thus the temples, with their stock of precious metal in the form of votive offerings, became banks. The Temple of Delos, through several centuries, lent at 10%. End of footnote. Under the influence of its own sort of capital, the economic life of the classical world took the form of a gold stream that flowed from the provinces to Rome and back, and was ever seeking new areas whose stock of worked-up gold had not yet been opened up. Brutus and Cassius carried the gold of Asia Minor on long mule trains to the battlefield of Philippi. One can imagine what sort of an economic operation the plunder of a camp after a battle must have been. And even Gaius Gracchus, almost a century earlier, alluded to the amphorae that went out from Rome to the provinces full of wine and came back full of gold. This hunt for the gold possessions of alien peoples corresponds exactly to the present-day hunt for coal, which in its deeper meaning is not a thing, but a store of energy. But equally, the classical craving for the near and present could not but match the polis ideal with an economic ideal of autarkeia, an economic atomization corresponding to the political. Each of these tiny life units desired to have an economic stream wholly of its own, wholly self-contained, circling independently of all others and within the radius of visibility. The polar opposite of this is the Western notion of the firm, which is thought of as an entirely impersonal and incorporeal centre of force, from which activity streams out in all directions to an indefinite distance, and which the proprietor, by his ability to think in money, does not represent, but possesses and directs, that is, has in his power, like a little cosmos. The duality of firm and proprietor would have been utterly unimaginable for the classical mind. Footnote. The idea of the firm took shape even in late Gothic times as ratio, hence the modern French phrase raison sociale, translator, or negotiatio. It is impossible to render it exactly in a classical language. Negotium meant for the Romans a concrete process, a deal, and not a business. End of footnote. Consequently, as the Western culture presents a maximum, so the classical shows a minimum of organization. For this was completely absent, even as an idea, from classical man. His finance was one of provisional expedience made rule and habit. The wealthy burgher of Athens and Rome could be burdened with the equipment of warships. The political power of the Roman aedile and his debts rested on the fact that he not only produced the games and the streets and the buildings, but paid for them too. Of course, he could recoup himself later by plundering his province. Sources of income were thought of only when the need of income presented itself, and then drawn upon without any regard for the future as the moment required, even at the cost of entirely destroying them. Plunder of the treasures of one's own temples, see piracy against one's own city, confiscation of the wealth of one's own fellow citizens were everyday methods of finance. If surpluses were available, they were distributed to the citizens, a proceeding to which plenty of people besides Eubulus of Athens owed their popularity. Budgets were as unknown as any other part of financial policy. The economic management of Roman provinces was a system of robbery, public and private, practiced by senators and financiers without the slightest consideration as to whether the exported values could be replaced. Never did classical man think of systematically intensifying his economic life, but ever looked to the result of the moment, the tangible quantum of cash. Imperial Rome would have gone down in ruin had it not been fortunate enough to possess, in old Egypt, a civilization that had for 1,000 years thought of nothing but the organization of its economy. The Roman neither comprehended nor was capable of copying this style of life. But the accident that Egypt provided the political possessor of this fellow world with an inexhaustible source of gold rendered it unnecessary for him to make a settled habit of prescription at home. The last of these financial operations in massacre form was that of 43, shortly before the incorporation of Egypt. The amassed gold of Asia Minor that Brutus and Cassius were then bringing up, which meant an army and the dominion of the world, made it necessary to put to the ban some 2,000 of the richest inhabitants of Italy, whose heads were brought to the forum in sacks for the offered rewards. It was no longer possible to spare even relatives, children and grey heads, or people who had never concerned themselves with politics. It was enough that they possessed a stock of cash and that the yield would otherwise have been too small. But with the extinction of the classical world feeling in the early imperial age, this mode of thinking in money disappeared also. Extended footnote. The Jews of those times were the Romans, and the Jews themselves were peasants and artisans and small traders. That is, they followed the very callings that in the Gothic period became the object of their merchant activity. Present-day Europe is in exactly the same position vis-à-vis the Russians, whose profoundly mystical inner life feels thinking in money as a sin. The pilgrim in Gorky's Night Asylum, and Tolstoy's thought generally. Here today, as in the Syria of Jesus's time, we have two economic worlds juxtaposed, an upper, alien and civilized world intruded from the West, the Bolshevism of the first years, totally Western and un-Russian, is the lees of this infiltration, and a townless barter life that goes on deep below, uncalculating and exchanging only for immediate needs. We have to think of the catchwords of the surface as a voice in which the Russian, simple and busied wholly with his soul, hears resignedly the will of God. Marxism amongst Russians is based on an inward misunderstanding. They bore with the higher economic life of Petrinism, but they neither created it nor recognized it. The Russian does not fight capital, but he does not comprehend it. Anyone who understands Dostoevsky will sense in these people a young humanity for which as yet no money exists, but only goods in relation to a life whose centre of gravity does not lie on the economical side. The horror of values supervening from nowhere, which before the war drove many to suicide, is a misconstrued literary disguise of the fact that for a townless barter thinking, money getting by means of money is an impiety, and from the viewpoint of the coming Russian religion, a sin. Today, with the towns of Tsarism in ruin, and the mankind in them living the village life under the crust, temporarily, of urban thinking Bolshevism, he has freed himself from the Western economy. His apocalyptic hatred, the same that the simple Jew of Jesus's day bore to the Roman, is directed against Petersburg, as a city and the seat of a political power of Western stamp, but also as the centre of a thinking in Western money that has poisoned and misdirected the whole life. The Russian of the deeps today is bringing into being a third kind of Christianity, still priestless and built on the John Gospel, a Christianity that stands much nearer to the Magian than to the Faustian, and consequently rests upon a new symbolism of baptism and looks neither at Rome nor at Wittenberg, but past Byzantium towards Jerusalem, with premonitions of coming crusades. This is the only thing that this new Russia really cares about, and it will no doubt let itself fall once again under the economy of the West, as the primitive Christian submitted to the Romans and the Gothic Christian to the Jews. But inwardly, it has no part nor lot therein. End of extended footnote. Coins again became wares, because men were again living the peasant life, and this explains the immense outflow of gold into the Far East after Hadrian's reign, which has hitherto been unaccountable. And as economic life in forms of gold streams was extinguished in the upheaval of a young culture, so also the slave ceased to be money, and the ebb of the gold was paralleled by that mass emancipation of the slaves which numerous imperial laws, from Augustus's reign onwards, tried in vain to check, till under Diocletian, in whose famous maximum tariff money economy was no longer the standpoint, the type of the classical slave had ceased to exist.